So this morning we were looking at a passage from Mark chapter 8 at the end of this chapter. Last week we were in this chapter and we were talking about Peter's great confession and then what happened immediately after that when Peter rebukes Jesus for his saying that he was going to die and Jesus' response to that. So what we're going to do this morning is pick up right after that happens and get into the discourse Jesus has, not with just his disciples, but with also the people that were there gathered around. There's some really important stuff in this text, which I think really applies to our kind of our world situation right now. And so we're gonna look at this and talk about it this morning. So it says, he summoned the crowd with his disciples, and he said to them, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Now, how many of you think that the church spends a lot of time emphasizing self-denial? We don't seem to emphasize self-denial a lot in church, right? Why do we not emphasize self-denial in church if Jesus emphasized self-denial in his ministry? Would anyone like to float a theory out? We don't like that part, right? We don't like that part. Now we call this and I was a communications major in college, one of my many majors in college, and so I remember this is what we call advertising. Okay, how many of you have ever seen a beer commercial where they advertised that it makes you fat and can lead to drunk driving? Never seen that in a beer commercial, right? In the beer commercials, no one's ever gets fat, and no one ever runs into a light pole. It's, you know, that's not how they work. One of my favorite commercials as a kid were the Colgate commercials. You remember Colgate? It's still out there, right? Colgate toothpaste still out there. In the Colgate commercials, when I was a kid, if you brushed your teeth with Colgate, you always got the girl. I can tell you from experience, that is not how Colgate works. Because I used Colgate in high school, and Linda Light never knew I was alive. Of course, she was a senior and I was a freshman, so that had something. But her locker was right next to mine. And I don't think Linda knew her entire senior year that my locker was there. And I used Colgate every morning. Todd, do you use Colgate? Well, see, there you go. That's just wrong toothpaste. That's what happens. When we do marketing, when we do advertising, when we want to make a product look attractive, we don't get into what we consider the negative stuff. We always emphasize the positive stuff. We want to put a positive spin on our product. Okay? We always do that. So let me ask you a question. Why would Jesus look at a group of followers and say, if anyone wants to come after me, you need to deny yourself? Now, we're going to start with the deny yourself part. Why would Jesus emphasize self-denial as a product of necessity in following him? Anyway? Because it's required. Good one, Chuck. It's required. We have developed this concept in the church. And it's not just in the church, but I think because this is where the Christians gather, we'll just use that term. And I'm using that, obviously, very generically. But we have developed this concept in the church that I can have Jesus on my terms. Right? I can have Jesus on my terms. I will worship Jesus when I choose to. Okay, if there are other things going on, he'll just have to wait till I'm good. Because, you know, there's other stuff happening. He'll have to wait on me. The other stuff doesn't wait on him. He has to wait on me. We've developed a concept that he's going to have to wait for us, that he's going to have to accept us. And there's this great term that's used in the church. And to me, it's kind of funny because it's a true term if you use it in its entirety. But the whole idea is Jesus comes to you as you are, right? But what's the second part of that? He doesn't expect you to do what? Stay like you are. The whole notion is Jesus will come to you as you are with the express idea of changing you. If you're going to come to me, you're going to have to deny the stuff you want and follow me. And we don't really emphasize that in the church because that doesn't sell in the community. When you go out and you're trying to witness people, and you're like, look, here's the deal. I would like you to get to know Jesus better. And by the way, you need to know that if you accept him, this lifestyle you're leading, that's going to have to go. That's got to go. This stuff that you were involved in, that's going to have to go. And the world's argument is, but this is how I am. How many of you have ever heard somebody's excuse for their poor behavior? Well, this is just how I am. God made me like this. I'm trying my best to picture me in the house with my mother. God rest her soul. I'm trying to picture me being in the house of my mother and me doing something stupid or saying something stupid and her saying, hey, that you better knock that nonsense off. And me looking at my mom and go, hey, this is how God made me. I feel confident that the response would have been, well, I'm fixing to send you to see him and you can talk about it with him when you get there. But this is the world's excuse for everything, right? I didn't choose to be homosexual. This is how God made me. I didn't choose to have a hard time committing to one person. This is just how God made me. I didn't choose to be this or to be that or to have this inclination or to be tempted by this sin. I didn't choose it. It's just how I am. And because it's just how I am, it's okay to be like that. And so Jesus is telling these people, he says, listen, rule number one of following me, you got to deny the things you want. The temptations, you got to deny those things. You got to put those things away. You can't use the excuse, well, this is just how I am. This is how I am. It's not, this is not my fault. Jesus says, you got to put that stuff away. Now, the next thing he says is really fantastic because a lot of times when we read this passage, we forget the order all this stuff is happening, right? What does Jesus tell them? Deny yourself and then do what? Take up your cross and follow me. Now, what hasn't happened yet? The cross hasn't happened yet. Jesus hasn't been crucified yet. So when Jesus looks at this audience and he says, here's the deal. If you want to be my disciple, you need to deny yourself and then you need to pick up your cross and follow me. You need to take up that cross and follow me. If you're a Jew and you're standing there listening to this, what is the cross? It's a symbol of persecution, right? It's a symbol of persecution and shame. If you were a Jew and you were crucified by the Romans, and by the way, the Romans had 1,000 ways to kill you, okay? If the Romans wanted to execute you, they had 1,000 ways to do it. There's a lot of efficient ways to kill people. By the way, the Apostle Paul, because he was a Roman citizen, how did they whack him? They beheaded him. Which, by the way, probably the best way to go. Because it's quick. Now, they say that you don't feel it. I'm not sure how anybody would know that. Because once it's happened to you, you don't really get a report about it. So I'm not sure. And they say, it doesn't hurt a bit. And I'm like, how do you know? Well, that's what I read on the internet. Internet said it doesn't hurt a bit. Now, I'm going to tell you. If you gave me a choice and said, beheading doesn't hurt a bit, or you can get crucified, guess what I know for a fact? Crucifixion hurts because it takes you a long time to die. And when I go, I want to go quick. I ain't interested in no pain. I don't want to be that guy. So when Jesus says, guys, if you're going to follow me, you need to deny yourself. You need to pick up your cross and follow me to a Jew. To a Jew, this is what they would hear. Let's see, the cross is a symbol of persecution by the Romans. If you were forced to carry a cross through the street, and by the way, remember, Jesus, when he was crucified, had to carry his cross to Golgotha. Why did the Romans make you tote your cross to the place they were going to execute you? It was symbolic of your subservience to their authority. Before you die, everybody's going to know that you have been submitted to the Roman authority. We're not just going to kill you. We're going to make you carry your cross to where you're going to die. It was a symbol of submission. It was a symbol of the authority of the Romans. And so when Jesus says, yeah, take up your cross and follow me, you know what he's saying? He's saying, guys, you're going to have to own submission. You're going to have to own the fact that you are submitting to me. And that taking up the cross is a symbol to everyone that sees you that you belong to me. Now, if you went into any church in Pitt County or really North Carolina, maybe even the United States, you went in any church this morning and you asked this simple question, does Jesus belong to you or do you belong to Jesus? How would you answer that question? If I ask you this morning, does Jesus belong to me or do I belong to him? Wait, what's the obvious right answer? We belong to him. Now let me ask you a question. How many of you in your relationship model that you belong to him and not the other way around? Now, we joke, men have this joke. We have this joke. And the joke is that women run the show. And every once in a while, our wives will let us think we're in charge. Right? Now we joke about that. I joke about that with my wife all the time. That, you know, I'll tell her, I have a phrase I use at the house. It's your world. I'm just living in it. And that's our joke. And we do this with the kids. The kids will come to me and ask me something like, why are you asking me? Is this a test run to see how it's going to go? Because you know as soon as I answer it, if you don't get the answer you want, where are they going? They're going to mom. They don't go to mom first, unless they think I'm going to say no. Now, we joke about it, but honestly, and Stephanie will tell you, it's like when we come down to a really serious decision, my input does matter. Some of you may be going, really? Steph, you could at least nod like, yeah, that's true. Okay. She's just sitting there going, I'm not sure why you use that analogy because that doesn't seem accurate at all. No, you know, if you went into any church this morning, everybody would know the right answer. Oh, I belong to him. But if you look at how most of us manage the relationship, it really seems more like he belongs to us. And that we're calling the shots, right? We decide when the relationship happens and when it doesn't. We decide when we're faithful and when we're not. We decide when we worship and when we don't. We decide when the communication happens through prayer. It's all based on us. I read my Bible when I choose to. I pray when I choose to. I give when I choose to. I worship when I choose to. But he's the boss. Now, does that make any sense at all? Does it make any sense at all that he's the boss, but we make all the decisions? No. And so in this simple passage, Jesus lays out the formula to be a disciple. And he says it's real simple. If you want to come after me, okay, if you want to be one of my disciples, it's real simple. Here's the thing. You need to deny yourself. These things that you want, you got to put those aside. And you got to take up your cross. Your public acknowledgement that you are submissive to me and my will, you need to pick that thing up and come after me. Follow me. Now, after he tells them that, Jesus goes into an analogy, which is, I love the analogy, so we're gonna do the analogy. He says, for whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. Now, we call that a paradox. I got thrown out of English class in high school for that very terminology. The English teacher, Miss Hall, who was fantastic, hardest teacher I had. Hated her until I got to college, then I loved her. Because when I got to Johnson and they made me write papers, and I had friends in class who'd never written a paper, and they were like, I don't know what to do. And I'm like, I know what to do. Praise Miss Hall. Yay, Miss Hall, who I hated in high school. We're sitting in English class one day, and Miss Hall says, Stuart. She called on me like I was paying attention. And she said, Stuart, what is a paradox? Lynn, did you ever have Miss Hall? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Stuart, what is a paradox? I went, that's two docs. Two doctors. Two doctors, that's a paradox. Ejected. I thought it was a good answer. I thought it was pretty. Now, I'll admit, as I exited the room, everyone was laughing. Because, I mean, let's be honest, that was pretty funny. But she didn't think it was funny. So anytime I use that word, I always think of Miss Hall. Whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. Okay, so when Jesus is putting this out there, he says, guys, here's the problem that you're going to deal with. And this is a paradox. It is an analogy, a metaphor that we have struggled with for 2,000 years. There is pressure from the outside world to not acknowledge Jesus and his teachings. Okay? There may be pressure at work. There's certainly pressure online. There may be pressure in school. You know, and trust me, I was the preacher's kid in high school, so I know how that pressure feels. This building sense that people are watching me, and they're watching me in a disapproving way because I have a belief system which is not popular in the modern world. My views on a lot of things are not popular. So now I have to make a decision about that belief system. Do I try to hide it? Do I try to keep it on the down low? Is that still a thing? Catherine's laughing. Apparently that's not still a phrase. Catherine's like, you're old, Mr. Stewart. That's been out for years. I don't want anybody to know. I'm not going to advertise my beliefs. I'm not going to share my beliefs because they're not. Here's our word. I know this one is still used. Inclusive. Our belief system isn't inclusive. There are churches now that actually advertise, you should come to our church because we're inclusive. How are you going to be the real church and be inclusive? But just by telling people you're fine just like you are, don't worry about it. Let me just tell you something. If you're telling the world they're fine the way they are, you're not the church. Amen. You are an imposter. You are a poser. You are not the church. Jesus didn't come to the world to tell everybody they were okay. If everybody was okay, he wouldn't have needed to come. He wouldn't have left the church behind to try to save people. He wouldn't have done that. He'd be like, hey, you know what? Hey, everybody's good. Everybody's great. We're just going to call it a day, judgment day. Hey, you just do your thing. You do you, and it's okay. So Jesus is like, look, here's the deal. If you're going to follow me, here's what you need to understand. If you spend all your time trying to save your life, that's going to end in you losing it. But if you're willing to lose your life, then you'll save it. Now, obviously, this is metaphorical because a lot of Christians died in persecution, right? So he's clearly not talking about the physical life because there are a lot of Christians who actually physically lost their lives by being followers of his. But here's the thing. This isn't about here. It's about eternity. And so he's telling him, he says, if you put all your energy into making your life here comfortable and accessible, then in eternity you're going to lose. If you focus your energy in this world on following me, you may be a loser here, but you're going to be a winner in eternity. And intellectually, we know that, right? I think if you ask most Christians, intellectually, do you believe that? The answer would be like, well, yeah. Yeah, I believe it. But here's the question. Do we practice it? Do we actually practice that? Now, this next verse is like where he takes this metaphor and he puts it into a question, which I really enjoy. He says in verse 36, "For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul?" Now, I want to ask you a question this morning, and I'll give you a second to kind of think about it. What is the price tag that you have put on your soul? Now, when you ask that question, people go, oh, no, dude, my soul doesn't have a price tag. I can't be bought. So I got online and I researched the phrase, everyone has a price. Everybody has a price. That actual phrase dates back all the way to the Roman Empire in different incarnations. That terminology has been used. But probably the most famous usage, and I get to tell this one because I'm a history guy, is a guy by the name of Robert Walpole. Now, do anybody in here know, anybody know who Robert Walpole is? Somebody who's taken my history class should be going, that name sounds eerily familiar. Robert Walpole was the finance minister and prime minister of England for a while when we were colonies. He is the guy under which they developed this concept that we just let the colonies go. We don't mess with them. They're making us money. We'll pass laws, but we're not going to enforce them. Anybody know what that's called? What? Salutary neglect. We're gonna pass laws, but we're not gonna enforce them because the colonies are making us money. So we're just gonna let them do their own thing because I know their price. And once Walpole was defending this in Parliament in England, and he stood up, and this is what he said about Parliament. He said, "I know everybody in this room, and I know everybody's price in this room, except three people." He didn't say who the three people were, which I would really kind of like to have known. But he said, everybody else in here, I know your price. I know your price. I know you can be bought, and I know what it costs to buy you. So when I ask you the question this morning, what is the price you have affixed on your soul? It's not a dollar value. It's generally not a dollar value. It's more stuff, right? It's more stuff. I saw a guy give a speech one time. I wish I could tell you his name. Don't remember. I looked for it online, could not find it. But this was a guy. He had grown up in a church. He was really passionate guy about his relationship with God. But he was cursed with athleticism. And he grew up saying that he wanted to be a minister. He was going to be a minister. He wanted to be a minister. And then people found out he could play ball. And so when he turned 18, he was drafted by a major league team out of high school. I don't remember what round. I think it was like in the teens, somewhere 14th, 15th round. Which, if you're a high school baseball player, that's pretty good. And in his talk, he said, I remember sitting there at the dinner table with my parents, and I remember thinking that my entire life I'd said I was going to be a minister. I was going to be a minister. I was going to go into youth ministry. This is what I was going to do. And now I've been drafted in the 14th, 15th round by some major league team. And now I have to decide what I want to do. How many of you can guess what he did? He went to play minor league baseball. Because he knew where the money was, right? Because I can tell you right now, you can be a minister for 175 years and not make what a Major League Baseball player makes in a good season, unless you're in a mega church, which you can look around and tell this is not a mega church. You can, I mean, you guys know what a baseball player's salary is now? Jamie, I was talking to Jamie the other day. I said, you think Carter's going to play football? He goes, no, baseball, that's where the money's at. There's not a lot of money in football. You hear that and go, what? There's no money in football? Baseball players? Anybody know what the top salary in baseball is right now? What? It's like $45 million a year somewhere in that ballpark to throw a ball. I should have practiced harder. That's what I'm thinking right now. Now, here's the problem. This guy, as he's given this speech, he said, I got into the minor leagues. He said, and then, of course, as fate would have it, I blew out my arm. And at 20 years old, I was washed up. He said, and I remember sitting in the hospital after the surgery. And I think he said it was like the second or third surgery on his elbow. And the doctor telling him, you're done. You're done. Your baseball career is over. He said, and I remember sitting there. He said, and it wasn't an audible thing. He goes, I'm not a mystic. He goes, I didn't hear an audible voice, but somewhere in my head, I could hear Jesus saying, you sold me out to play baseball. You had promised me your whole life you were going to go into ministry. And as soon as you got drafted, it was gone. He said, at that point, I realized that the price of my soul was a 15th round draft pick. That was the price I'd put on it. He said, now some people would say, well, you're being a little harsh. He said, let's not kid ourselves. When I was in minor leagues, I did not go to church. He said, I was too busy. I didn't have time. He said, I had all these great plans. I was going to lead a Bible study with my baseball team. He said, that kind of went away. He said, and I kind of got away from God pretty quickly when I got in the minor league system. And he said, that was the price I had put. He said, and it had nothing to do. He said, and he was very clear. He said, this is not a statement that you can't be a Christian, be a professional athlete. He said, but the problem was I had committed myself to ministry. I had promised God that's what I was going to do. And I lied. I gave that up for a 15th round pick. The reality is everybody in this room has a price. Your price may be a particular temptation. Your price may be a particular fear. Your price may be any number. It could be a goal in your life. I want to achieve this, and to achieve this, I'm going to have to sacrifice that. And a lot of times that is God. But we all have a price. And guess who knows your price? Satan knows your price. Satan knows your price. And so Jesus, he poses this question. He says, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? And you start thinking about that question, and you know, when you're a kid growing up in church and you think, I'm never going to turn away. I'm always going to be faithful. I'm always going to go to church. And if I could tell you this morning some of the stories I've heard over the years, you know, I got in college and I got in grad school and I was trying to climb the ladder. I was trying to get that promotion, and to get that next promotion, I had to cut some things out of my life. I remember talking to a guy one time who had gotten promotion after promotion after promotion, and he finally achieved a level that he wanted to be in his career, and his family was gone. His relationship with God was, he had lost his family because he was never at home. He neglected his wife and children to the point that they finally left, and he barely noticed. He had no relationship with God anymore because he had given up church long before because he had to be involved in the business thing. And he had finally reached that point that he wanted to get to so badly, and he realized that when he got there by himself. He said, and I had all the money I could spend. He told me, he said, Stuart, I was making so much money, I didn't even miss the child support. He said, I was making so much money. He said, I was making more money than I ever dreamed of. He said, and I was sitting at home in my house one night alone. And I thought, what good is all this money? My children hate me. They wouldn't even open it. He would send them presents at Christmas. They would send them back. They didn't even want them. Because they felt so much animosity towards him because he abandoned them for his career. His career was not about providing for those children. That's not why he was doing it. He was doing it. He said, he told me this. He said, it was never about making a better life for my wife or making a better life for my children or so that I could give more money to the church. It was never about any of those things. It was about me. I wanted to achieve. And I wanted it so badly that I lost my wife, my children, my parents. He said, I didn't even go. He said, I didn't go to my dad's funeral because I had a business trip I couldn't miss. He said, and you know what my excuse was? He said, I told my other family, my siblings, Dad would understand. And he said, you know what my siblings told me? You're right, he would. This is where you got that. This drive to succeed. He had learned it honestly. He had gotten it from his dad. And he said, and one day I wake up with over $1 million in my bank account and nobody to share it with. He said, I'm living in a house that was beyond anything I ever dreamed of, and I'm in it alone. He said, the sad thing is I've reached a point in my life where I don't trust anybody because I think everybody that wants to spend time with me wants something from me because of my money. And I remember him looking at me and saying, how do I ever get back to where I was? And I didn't have a great answer. Yeah, it's always nice when the preacher's got a great answer. Like, what did Jesus say? Give it all away. Give it all away. You know, because you have much money. Give everything away and follow Jesus. But you know what? That wasn't going to get his wife and kids back. They were gone. As you sit here today and you analyze that question, you're like, what is the price tag I have put on my soul? Is it my family? Is my family more important to me than Jesus? Is my athletic career more important than Jesus? Are my academics more important? Is my career more important? And we sit there and we go, oh, and intellectually we argue in our head, well, nothing is really more important. But it's not a question of what we say, it's a question of what we do. And Jesus understood that. And so when he put this question out there, he said, what's going to be the benefit? If you stand before Caesar one day and deny me to Caesar so that you can live, what are you going to gain? 20 years? 10 years? You're going to trade 10 more years of life for eternity? That the trade you're willing to make? That next promotion, is that worth your soul? Yeah, if straight A's. Oh, Mr. Stewart, look, I can't come to youth group. I can't, I don't have time because I'm trying. I got to make an A in this class. I can't make a B. One of the sad things in the world is that we have Christian parents who accommodate this. They teach their kids school before Jesus. Now, listen. Some of you are sitting there going, hey, you're stepping into stuff ain't your business. That's what they pay me to do. Just so y'all know, that's why I get my check. My job is to step into stuff that ain't none of my business. So if that offends you, if you're sitting there going, Stuart, I don't like that, it's okay. I don't mind offending people. Ask anybody, they'll tell you. I don't enjoy it, but I mean, let's be honest. I have watched kids grow up in church and be taught that there are 7 things more important than Jesus. I've watched it happen. And I'm not saying, now notice, Jesus doesn't say that you can't have anything and have me. He doesn't say that you can't excel. In fact, he wants you to excel. He just doesn't want you to do it at his expense. So one of the things that we have to accept as Christians is that there is a price tag that we put on our soul, whether we'll announce it or not, whether we say it or not, whether we verbalize it or not, there's a price tag that we've put on it. And if you're sitting there thinking, I don't know if I've ever done that, let me ask you, just ask yourself a question. What are the things you put ahead of Jesus? That's the tag. That's the tag. And so what you have to figure out how to do is, how do I use Jesus as part of what I'm doing? I got invited several years ago to speak in Washington at First Church of Christ at their youth thing they used to do on Sunday night. What was that called? The Path. I got invited to speak at The Path. And I remember that night I got up, and one of the things I said, you know, I wish now I could be youth minister again. I wish I knew then what I know now. And I said, I used to have kids in the youth group that were involved in all these athletic things, and I used to, because I thought the right thing to do was try to make them choose between the two, and that's not what I should have been doing. What I should have been doing is, hey, if you're in a travel ball team, I should have been teaching those kids to lead devotions with your team. If you're going to be gone on the weekend to a travel ball tournament, then be a missionary while you're there. You, hey, guys, look, I can't be at church today, so here's what I'm going to do. Between games, we're going to get together and have a Bible study. Anybody wants to come, I'm going to. I said, I failed in some respect as a minister because I wasn't teaching kids, look, if you're going to be involved in these things, include Jesus in them. Make him the central point. This is my chance to be a missionary to kids who don't go to church. This is my opportunity. I can do this through my athletics. Hey, I'm involved in academics at school. This is my chance to reach people. We've got to learn that Jesus doesn't want us to give up everything for him. He wants us to include him in everything. And we've got this thing all backwards. The way we emphasize things, and we go, there's no price tag, there's no choices. I don't believe in that stuff. I'll just take Jesus as it comes, and he'll understand. You know, that guy told me, he said, there was a time when I was working 19 hours a day that I convinced myself that my wife understood. He said, you know when I figured out she didn't? The day I came home, the house was empty. She and the kids were gone. He said, you know the crazy thing, Stuart? She had told me before, and I refused to believe it. I just didn't acknowledge it. She doesn't mean that. She understands what I'm trying to accomplish here. No, she didn't. And we convince ourselves sometimes, well, Jesus understands. Jesus understands that I want to excel at this and I want to excel at that and I want to be really good at this. And he understands that I have to sacrifice him in the short term to reach my long-term goals. I want to tell y'all something. He doesn't understand. Because that passage clearly says he doesn't understand. His question for you is, what are you trying to gain? What are you trying to gain here? What is it you think you're going to get out of this? Is your goal to be the best baseball player in hell? Is your goal to be the most successful business person in hell? Is that what we're shooting for here? I want the highest GPA in hell. That's what I want to accomplish. I want to be the smartest person. Let me tell you something. I'd rather be the stupidest person in heaven than the smartest person in hell. And by the way, when I get to heaven, and I'm gonna get there, I'm gonna have the lowest batting average at heaven. Because I couldn't hit a lick. Aaron thinks that's funny. It's true, Aaron. I had a great arm, good glove. I batted behind the pitcher. Pitcher batted eighth, I batted ninth. I played right field and batted ninth. I was the worst hitter on my team for 4 straight years. And I would come up with 2 outs and nobody on, and the coach would go, bunt, just bunt. Don't embarrass yourself. Don't swing. Just bunt. I'm pretty sure my batting average for 4 years of high school was somewhere around 1 something. And a lot of those hits were bunts because I was fast before I got fat. Golden hair flowing in the wind as I ran to beat out the bunt. I hit a double one time and celebrated like I'd hit a home run. I trotted to second base. I could have had a triple, but I was trotting because I was like, I got the ball in the outfield, in the gap. My coach was like, what are you doing? He goes, you're trotting like you hit a home run. I said, dude, that was a home run for me. That was a home run for me. I was proud of that thing. I wish I had, if I'd had a cell phone back then, I'd have stopped and filmed it while I was running the bases. But the reality is, I don't want anybody to misunderstand, because I fear that sometimes when we get on these kind of topics, people misunderstand. I'm not saying to the kids over here, don't make good grades in school. I'm not saying to the people in this room who are professionals, don't exceed, don't try to do good. That's not what I'm saying. God wants you to do the best you can with the tools he's given you, with the gifts he's given you. No one's suggesting that you should not excel at those things. But here's the key. You cannot do it at the expense of Jesus. You can't. Because if you do, he's going to stand in front of you one day on judgment, and he's going to look at you and go, what did it profit you to gain all that stuff? And now, depart from me. I don't know you. You turned your back on me to be successful. I don't know you. Jesus finishes with these statements. He says, for what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Can you imagine the number of times you've downplayed your faith because you didn't want to be embarrassed because your views and your morals seemed outdated? Any of you ever felt like that's how people view Christians? We have outdated morality. We don't fit in this modern world. You know, we don't look at everything that's going on and going, oh yeah, it makes perfect sense to me. We're not woke enough, or we're not hip enough to what's going on. Somebody said, you just use hip and woke in the same sentence. That's a paradox, Stuart. That's what that is. That's a paradox. Is that what you're thinking? Yeah, that's exactly what you're thinking. She just tweeted it. My preacher just said hip and woke at the same sentence. A man living in two eras. But that's the reality of how it is. Look, listen, I get it. I remember being a preacher's kid and being ashamed of that in high school. And trying to prove to people that I was not as righteous as you think I am. I remember doing that. I'm not proud of it, but I remember doing it. I remember going out of my way. I was the foul-mouthest kid in my class. And it wasn't an accident. I didn't hear that stuff at home. But I wanted to prove that I was okay, that you could hang out with me, that I wasn't going to be that guy that was too good. And it's funny because now I see friends from high school and they said, you're a preacher? Really? That's almost impossible to believe. And I understand why they say that. I totally get it. And so for the younger people, I'm like, don't make the same mistake I made. Because here's the thing. But for the grace of God, I would have stood before him at 18 years old and he'd have been like, I don't know you. And I'm like, how can you say that? He's like, well, you always tell people you didn't know me. That's what he's saying here, right? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words, in other words, my teachings, if you're ashamed of me and my teachings in this adulterous and sinful generation, does that sound like where you're living right now? He says, anyone who is ashamed of me and my teachings in this generation, I'm going to be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father and his holy angels. In other words, one day you're going to stand before God and he's going to look at me as your advocate on judgment day. God's going to look at Jesus and go, what do you think? You know this guy? And Jesus is going to be like, no. No, I don't know you. I don't know you. And you're going to be like, how can you say that? I went to church. I went to church camp. I went to youth group. I sang in the choir. I was in the praise. How can you say you don't know me? And he's going to be, you want me to go to the film? And see how many times you denied me? At work? At school? On the golf course? At the ball field? In your house with your family? You want me to go to the tape and show how many times you didn't know me? Now, I don't know you. Now, there's not a lot of passages that are more clear than this one, right? I mean, there's not a lot of fuzzy gray area here, right? Jesus is pretty specific, right? If you're ashamed of me and my words in this generation, I'm going to be ashamed of you when he comes in the glory of his Father. Guys, this morning, as the praise team comes to lead us in our communion hymn, I want you to ask yourself a very painfully honest question, and it's a question that nobody can answer but you, and that's this. What is the tag? What is the price that you have affixed to your soul? Nobody knows that but you. And some of you may be, I've never really even thought about it, Stuart. I've never it never occurred to me that I had one. But the truth is, we probably all have one. And so we need to do some serious soul searching as we look at that and we ask ourselves, is this tag, is this thing in my life really worth hearing Jesus one day say, I don't know you? Is there anything you could achieve in this world that would be worth hearing the Son of God look at you and say, you denied me, and now I am denying you.